Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see a Jew.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
What? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See, the podcast, season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out, it's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
Do you read Stephen King? Good news. There's a club for you. The Losers Club. Every Friday, us losers journey through the never-ending wastelands of King's Dominion. We sink our teeth into each of King's novels, dive deep into the lore, and review every adaptation. Even better, we're always having guests over. Thomas Jane, Will Wheaton, Mary Lambert, Mick Garris, the list goes on. So what are you waiting for? Join us as we read on through long days and pleasant nights.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's an audio interview series presented by WFPK, Independent Louisville, at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Want to say hello to the subscribers. Thank you all for checking out the series, whether you do it once a week with all the interviews that we put out, or you listen in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with the new interviews that's released on those days. Love seeing your comments that you're leaving in the various places that you're listing. Please continue to keep doing that. And if you haven't given the series a rating or review, that's always a huge help. So here's the encouragement. If you're not a subscriber, go ahead and hit that subscribe button, whether it's your first time checking us out or you've been here before. It's a great way to keep up with all your favorite artists and what they're up to. Just grab your listening device, head to where you get your podcast from, wherever you're listening to this right now, and hit that subscribe button. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, I am talking with one of the greatest actors of our time, one of the greatest artists of all time, a man that takes his craft seriously and makes it look like total fun. I'm talking about Edward Norton. He has just released a movie called Motherless Brooklyn. This is a movie that he wrote the screenplay to, directed the film, has the starring role in, a passion project of his for 20 years. And with it set in 1950s New York, Edward and I are going to take the opportunity to talk about the music of the film. It's the one thing that, you know, he didn't do. He took the era deep into the jazz, hard bop era that was happening around that time, called up Wynton Marsalis, who put together just this amazing band of his to not only feature in the film, but put together this actual soundtrack. So we're going to talk about how he ended up in that era and that type of music and working with Wynton and the band and how that relates to the score that was done by Daniel Pemberton. It's a very noir-ish score to fit a very noirish movie. It is beautiful, it is haunting, and it's perfect complements to what Wynton is doing on the jazz side of it. And right in the middle of those two, with the song on the soundtrack, Thom Yorke of Radiohead, Flea of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, they collaborated on a song called Daily Battles. You will hear me say this multiple times in the interview. It is the perfect middle ground to tie. It's the Lebowski rug is what it is. It ties the whole room together. So we're going to hear about the whole process, working with these amazing artists, the conversations they had to get to these moments, and how it works within the movie, how they relate to the characters, how they push the characters along, but honestly, how the songs even stand on their own. If you've never seen the movie, you could listen to the soundtrack and the score and see a version of the movie in your head. It's a perfect compliment in that way. This interview is also just a great excuse for Edward Norton and I to geek out about music. That's what this is. And what's fun is he talks about being very fortunate in his career to reach out to the artists that he admires to work with them. And that's the moment I'm having right now. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be fanboyish and tell you that's the moment I'm having. I'm very fortunate right now, right here, to be talking with one of my favorite artists of all time, discussing the movie Motherless Brooklyn. It's Kyle Meredith with Edward Norton.
My pleasure.
We're talking about Motherless Brooklyn. In fact, we're going to talk a lot about the music of Motherless Brooklyn, which, as I was looking at this, you know, here's this this movie that's getting these great reviews. You've written the screenplay. You've directed the film. You're starring in the film. And it seems like the only thing you didn't do was actually made the music of the film. But it's a powerful soundtrack that I've been listening to. And you originally took the story, the original book, from the 90s to the 50s. There was more music than just jazz in the past, but was there any reason why you kind of directed straight towards that sound?
Well, if there's any style of music ever that has a turretic quality to it, I would say it's mid-50s bop and hard bop. It's the idea of compulsively looping around a phrase, twisting it, reshaping it, is that language could describe jazz just as easily as Tourette's. And I loved that idea that somehow it's an analogy for the way Lionel's head works. But in him, it's something he always wants to suppress. And in jazz, it's joyful. And that I love the idea that somewhere along the way, he finally encounters this thing that for once lets him enjoy himself without restraint, as opposed to always trying to suppress these impulses, and that he finds kind of this identification with the trumpet player.
I found my own relation to that in, I'm in my late 30s now and thinking back into my early 20s when things were a little bit out of control. And I found, I guess, what they were doing more in the late 60s, early 70s with freeform and acid jazz and everything. And so what you're talking about, while I don't have Tourette's, I can kind of exactly see where the character would find that direction himself. And I'd wondered about the other side of it, because at its height, you know, jazz, it was dangerous. There was always something about it. I mean, the best music of all time has always had that sense of danger to it.
I wouldn't necessarily say danger. I feel like what was going on in jazz was somewhat socially revolutionary, in the sense that, you know, as Wynton will often say, jazz was integrated long before even sports was. And African-American men in jazz were doing an end run around the discrimination of that era, becoming icons, you know, stars. And that was a shift even from the 40s. You know, obviously there had been sort of big band leaders and stars, but people like Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis were becoming international stars in the post-war era, especially, you know, across the 50s. And it was like suddenly you had musicians and artists liberating themselves from the discrimination that was sort of the baseline experience for most people not that they didn't experience it, but they were going to Paris and being treated like stars and starting to experience the potency of their talent, you know? And I liked the idea of that being webbed into it in the character of the trumpet player.
You mentioned Wynton, and you know, we'll talk about that in the soundtrack too. While you do have a classic track with Dizzy and Charlie Anthelonius on there with Relaxing with Lee, most of it does sit around Wynton Marsalis and the band that he put together. What was the collaborative process between the two of you like?
Well, I should highlight to say that we only have a couple of like what I'd call needle drops, you know, of old period recordings. And those are specifically when someone's playing something on a radio, you know, so like the Bird and Diz track from that Verve record, Bird and Diz, Relaxing with Lee, that's in the car on the radio. And so is the Babs Gonzalez Round Midnight. Those are things we actually hear coming over a radio. Everything else that's heard is either played live in the club scene or is the score, which Wynton and his guys play a lot of, not all of, because it's obviously a big orchestral jazz score, but Wynton plays the lead trumpet on a lot of the score, as well as it's his trumpet under Michael K. Williams, you know, character playing.
I don't know, when you've got to have that conversation, you know, to talk about, you know, this is the era that it's going to be in. I mean, he's a master at this, obviously. I've been lucky to see him a handful of times here in Louisville and watch him do his thing. But I guess, do you have to give Wynton direction when you say, look, we're looking at the 1950s, so what you're doing in these songs needs to sound exactly like that from the period? Or is it kind of allowed to sound contemporary looking back?
No, the live music in the club, we wanted to have it feel like appropriate to that era, the style of that era. And we picked things together that both served the what we wanted out of the scene. Like the first track is Clifford Brown, Max Roach, Blues Walk. We picked that because it's fun. It's celebratory. It's the beginning of their date in a way. And something's happening between them. He's starting to have fun. And that piece has an upbeat, up-tempo, joyful vibe to it. Later, when he's getting a little bit hammered and things are getting a little weird and he gets, like, you know, roughhoused out of the club, we went with Jump Monk, the Mingus track Jump Monk, because it's more, because it's chaotic. It's chaotic and dissonant, and it feels sort of like a fight is brewing. You know what I mean? It's a piece that fits the moment. But those, we definitely went and orchestrated them to be very much in the style, specifically in the style that would have been right for the time. Mm-hmm. The score itself has much more of what I'd call like a neo-noir or it's got obviously very classical melodies on tracks that are on the soundtrack, like Woman in Blue and the Motherless Brooklyn theme, the Lionel theme. Those are very lyrical and evocative, and Wynton and Daniel Pemberton created some almost like jazz standard versions of those. But throughout the score, there's also a lot of strange dissonance, you know, circular breathing and very dissonant, even jazz riffs played rewound and played backwards at high speed to create strange kind of soundscapes. And that's, you know, Daniel Pemberton's really great work. But Wynton and his guys and a bunch of good players in London all also, you know, really brought their chops to creating a very amelodic and arrhythmic and dissonant landscape of sound out, but using traditional instruments of a quintet, you know?
And I did want to compliment that Daniel Pemberton score too. It was gray and rainy here yesterday, and I had the score playing on the way home. And I tell you, if I were allowing myself to be transported back to that moment, it did it. Every bit of that score was perfect for that kind of feeling.
Yeah, he is a real, he's as great a talent working in film music as I've run into these days. He is a real a savant. He's a gifted and passionate composer. Wynton was super, super impressed with the score overall, and more so because Daniel wrote the whole score in something like 4 weeks, which is really rather remarkable.
But the way it all plays together, and you know, I'll talk about the connecting piece here too with Tom York and Flea doing Daily Battles. Because it is one of those times where you can see the movie, whether you've seen it or not, in your head just by listening to kind of these you know, three pieces, what Wynton's doing, what Daniel's doing, and of course what Tom and Flea are doing in there. It's easy to kind of see what I should be seeing. Does that make sense?
Yes, I'm glad. I really like that observation, and it makes me happy because I think that film music, when it's just a mirror of what's happening on the screen, I call it like an emotional amplifier. that's not super interesting, because when you take those scores and you listen to them by themselves, they're really not doing much. They're kind of like these pads of enhancement to a simplistic emotional tone, and you can't see the scene, right? So you're like, I don't know what this is in reference to, really. But I think what I love is what Daniel did, like when Lionel's following Laura, this girl who he has no idea who she is, in a blue coat through the city. He writes, there's mystery and kind of uncertainty in the music, but then without her ever having opened her mouth, a theme begins that starts to actually tell you about her. You start to grasp that she's a good person, that there's a kind of a draw toward her goodness and toward her, the allure of her. And that theme, The Woman in Blue, is so beautiful on its own that honestly, consciously or unconsciously, you sort of start to fall for her. You know what I mean? Just there's a romance. There's such a longing and a romance and a sense of poignancy in that track with its own melodic story that you start to feel things that the movie hasn't even really revealed yet. And that's really great film writing. That's what the theme of Chinatown does, honestly. Mm-hmm. Jerry Goldsmith's great. You know, it's that movie opens and you feel something very distinct before you literally even know what this is going to be about. It tells you that there's going to be loss in the story. That's the stuff that's really becomes classic, I think. Yeah. Stands on its own feet, as you're saying. Is it a composition that actually stands on its own? And Winton and the guys, those two pieces, Woman in Blue and Motherless Theme, those guys all read it, and like Winton looked at Daniel and was like, these are straight up standards. And the fact that they were able to cut them, you know, on the soundtrack, we have those two pieces of the score. Those are the closing titles, and they orchestrated them as, you know, jazz standards. And you can't do that with much film music.
That's those moments that instantly creates nostalgia, you know, to kind of play around with time loops there for a second, because, you know, the assault on the senses, film can do one thing and the music can do one thing. But when it all matches up like that, I mean, that's the moments where you look back and you hear the piece 5-10 years later and you're going, no, I know exactly what's going on. Those are those perfect, perfect.
I agree. Yes. Actually, Daniel and I, this will sound like this will be a completely off center reference, but when we first met, we talked about the Vangelis score of Chariots of Fire, which couldn't have less to do with Motherless Brooklyn and jazz, but it's a 1920s running film with a synth score over it and then a classical piano. It's a mashup of this kind of very modernist idea.
Oh, right.
With this instantly memorable ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. And if you play that for people, their mind, they not only can return to the film, they kind of go to a place, like you say, of memory. They remember the emotion of that time in life. It's that good a piece. And we both loved that, the boldness of that choice to do a 1920s running film, but to do music that almost said, this is timeless. This is universal. These young men testing themselves, and it made it modern at the same time. And it's genius. And think about how that score owns running. I mean, literally, people running in slow motion is defined by the Chariots of Fire score, literally.
Absolutely.
You know, for decades it was. And I think that's really, it's really special when that kind of thing happens. But that's it's much more bold when you really stop and think about it. It's a very, very bold choice to do that kind of a score on that kind of a film. And I think, you know, what I loved about working with Daniel is when I said to him, like, I got Tom York and I've got Wynton Marsalis and we've got to build a score that fuses those sensibilities, he was so lit up about that idea, like really lit up about it. He didn't go, ooh, that's like olives and chocolate. That doesn't go together. You know what I mean?
Olives and chocolate. Well, we positively have to talk about Tom York and Flea in this beautiful, haunting song with Daily Battles. I mean, you know, Radiohead's one of the most important bands of my life. God knows I've spent enough time with their music. Let's hear about this, though, because Daily Battles is something different. And I call it the great piece between what Wynton does and what Daniel does, because it does seem to kind of put the two together. But I'd love to hear the story about this and how it fits into the movie.
I've known Tom a long time, since those guys were playing little clubs in New York. I'd say we've known each other over 20 years. And I feel all the same things you said. They've been one of the definitive bands. And as a writer, he's been one of the people in our generation, I think, who's really captured a sense of personal emotional longing and melancholy, but also grafted on top of it a sense of like social stress. You know what I mean? The modern age, right? He's the commentary in those songs is emotional and personal, but it's also there's also a big social critique in it, right? And he deals with just sort of the fracture of living in the times we're living in. And I don't think everybody does that. Not everybody. I mean, that's to me like what Spike Lee does as a filmmaker. He makes very entertaining films, but he's a really deep social commentary is laced in Spike's films in a way that most people don't even attempt. And I just thought I couldn't get the idea out of my head that in some ways Lionel and his very chaotic brain, but his lonely heart were sort of that it's the same straddle. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I put it to Tom to just say, could you write a ballad that encompasses that straddle of personal loneliness, but also a sense of the times that you're living in? And I sent him the script and he wrote that song in response to the script. And it had such an impact on me that I actually altered things in the screenplay. I included the phrase daily battles when Laura says to Lionel in the car, when he's complaining about his condition, and she said, we've all got our daily battles, right? And it sort of makes him realize that he's wallowing a little bit, and she's a black woman who's a lawyer, and everybody sees her as a secretary, and she's watched her deal with sort of daily casual racism, and it sort of like makes him sit up a little straighter, you know? And there's a line in the song, in Tom's song, about how the other side has no face, and, you know, almost like how difficult it is to even understand where the dark forces that affect you are. And I liked that line so much. I actually sketched out a storyboard of meeting Alec Baldwin's character without seeing his face, swimming in the pool and walking away from us and getting into the car without his face. And then the inauguration of the mayor, but there's this faceless person in the shadows who's obviously more powerful. And that was very affected by the song. But then we wanted the song, Tom, you know, sketched it on the piano with his voice, and we wanted it to blend with the language of the film. And so Tom and Flea have worked together. Flea is a very old friend of mine. I've known him even longer than Tom, and people don't know, but he's a really great trumpet player on top of a great bassist. And he went back, I don't even remember how long ago, Flea went back to USC and did a advanced degree in composition theory on trumpet, and I knew that. And I said to Tom, like, what if we grab Flea to, by putting bass and horn in it, but our way, your way, we can connect the musical voicing of your song to the rest of the film. And so Flea layered those you know, instruments into it, and then Tom ran them through compressors and reversed them. And it's really great because it just having the presence of that horn, it anchors it literally in the instrumental language of the rest of the film, but it has Tom's very unique kind of surrealism, which is great because it's right when Lionel smokes the opium or whatever it is he's smoking that sort of makes him start to trip out. And I love the way Tom takes Flea's horn and alters it so that the altered state that Lionel's getting into is literally reflected in the horn. It's just great. It's great stuff. Again, it on paper, when you said it to people, they were like, I don't really see how those things are going to go together, but you just have to kind of have faith. I knew Tom loves Mingus Blues and Roots, and he's quite obsessed with the dissonance in jazz, in some of that more experimental jazz that started happening in the late 50s. And I knew it was going to work. I didn't know Tom was going to write such a great song, but I knew that the voicings could integrate, and they did. Winton did the arrangement of it that, as if it was a Miles Davis ballad, that's what's playing when they dance in the club is a 50s Miles Davis style arrangement of Tom's song. And that was super cool. Tom loved that. And Daniel was able to take inspiration from sort of what I would call the Radiohead playbook and do some very unexpected stuff in the score that, like I said, you know, more dissonant things, circular breathing on the sax and putting pianos and cymbals backwards and all kinds of cool stuff he did.
Like I said, it all come together so perfectly, and hearing, you know, how it works, it's beautiful. It really is, and it's a perfect compliment to what you've done here on the film.
The wrapper on it to me is like the best thing about directing, other than telling a story you want to tell, is that you get to ring up the people that whose work you think is the best, and you get to ask them to come in and elevate your piece, you know. And so, like, when you get to call on people who do the stuff you love and say, this may be an unusual mashup, but it's the mashup of the things that I love. You're just sort of, you know, you have to just sort of take the bet that that is going to work for someone else too, you know, and hope that it all comes together. But at a certain point, like, what a waste. Why work that hard if you're not going to get to at least work with some of your heroes? You know what I mean?
Right. It's a good way to spend a day anyway. Spend a life. Spend a career. But we benefit, and you know, I'd like to say that we do. You know, we as the fans, as the watchers, as the listeners, we benefit from your hero worship, I guess. To kind of
thanks. Well, I mean, I haven't gotten tired of listening to the soundtrack, which is saying a lot because I've heard it a lot. I literally am still putting it on because it's I really love the mashup that came out of it.
All right, Edward, thank you again so much for taking the time to talk to me about this, man. It was a lot of fun.
Appreciate it.
All right.
Thanks. Bye.
A humongous thanks to Edward Norton. The movie is called Motherless Brooklyn. The soundtrack, the score, is also called Motherless Brooklyn. And the single, Thom Yorke and Flea, that's called Daily Battles. And thanks to you for checking out the episode. Again, if you're not already a subscriber to the series, I hope you had enough fun that you're going to hit the subscribe button and keep up with all the episodes that we put out. New ones every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Interviews with all of your favorite artists. You can follow along anywhere you get your podcasts from. That includes iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Podchaser, Stitcher, Acast, any of those spots. And if you're already subscribed, please do think about giving the series a rating, leaving a review, or just saying hi in the comment box. After that, head to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. It's an hour of song premieres, of music news, anniversary spins, and bonus interviews. Again, that's WFPK.org. Consequence of Sound has your music and film news. You can also find me at Twitter at Kyle Meredith, Facebook/Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.